This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. This is what lies at the core of Dr. Mel Levine's philosophy of education. No kid should ever feel stupid in school. Levine is a professor of pediatrics at the University of North Carolina Medical School in Chapel Hill. He studies how children learn, and he says that while every mind works differently, our schools tend to use a one-size-fits-all approach to teaching. As a result, a lot of kids fall through the cracks. Levine is the co-founder and co-director of a nonprofit institute, All Kinds of Minds, which trains teachers and parents in identifying why a child is struggling in school and what they can do to help. In his new book, One Mind at a Time, Levine breaks learning down into 8 neurological processes: memory, language, spatial ordering, sequencing, motor skills, attention, social thinking, and higher thinking. I asked Mel Levine to give an example of a child having a problem with sequencing.
The teacher says, "Okay, class, can you open your books to page 14 and copy down those new words? And then I'd like you to turn to the end of the chapter and answer the 2 questions at the top of the page. Then close your books, put down your pencils, and sit up straight so I'll know you're finished." Michael heard something about a pencil, but he doesn't process sequences of information. He's also confused about time, doesn't quite know the months of the year and the days of the week, has trouble remembering to do things in the right order when he solves a math problem, may have difficulty narrating an experience he had and getting the results in the right order. And so anything that involves preserving a particular order confuses this child.
So he just hear that list of instructions and like deer in a headlight freeze.
Exactly. At home, his parents have noticed the same thing. "Hey, Michael, why don't you go put out the trash and then come back and pour yourself a glass of milk and put your pajamas on and come on and watch TV with us." 20 minutes later, what happened to Michael? He's walking around half naked in the kitchen. The dog is following him. Couldn't handle the sequence.
Now, how about higher thinking? What do you mean by that?
Higher thinking, in many ways, is our most sophisticated level of attainment. It includes things like the ability to really and truly understand concepts, like the concept of liberalism or the concept of photosynthesis or the concept of irony in a story. And by being able to solidify concepts in your mind, education for you will have much less emphasis on rote memory. You'll be able to compare and contrast things. You'll be able to really enjoy and appreciate the flow of ideas in school rather than feeling you just have to kind of absorb and regurgitate them.
So this is the real meat of knowledge.
This is the meat. This is the essence. And you'd be astounded at how many students don't quite ever attain this and don't know they're not attaining it, and their teachers are unaware of it.
Now, how do the different parts of the mind, as you define them, these parts, work together? Is it like an orchestra? Do you have a conductor?
Absolutely. And by the way, the conductor is called attention. The attention controls. And it's very much like an orchestra. In fact, one of the things we're trying to teach teachers to do and also clinicians to do is to look at different academic tasks and figure out the composition of the orchestra. In other words, what functions are required to solve a word problem in math? What functions are required to make friends and be able to keep friends? What functions are needed to write a report in fourth grade? What aspects of memory? What components of language? What kinds of sequencing and other organizational functions are going to have to be brought together to play that piece of music, so to speak? And then if there's a child who can't do something, for example, she can't do word problems, we can say, where's the breakdown occurring? In other words, which member of the orchestra didn't show up?
Now, you break attention down into a number of different components, too. And I guess my question is, what is a kid like who has weak attention control? And are these the kids that we call ADD or often get labeled ADD?
They often get labeled ADD. I and my colleagues don't label anyone anything. We don't use terms like LD or ADD because we feel they don't really capture the essence of a child. They oversimplify kids. And also, they result in misdiagnosis all the time. For example, if you have trouble understanding language in the classroom, aren't you going to stop paying attention? And everybody's going to say you have ADD and miss the point. that you really had difficulty keeping up with the tumultuous tide of language all day long in the classroom. And so we much prefer to be much more specific. And by the way, the other problems that occur with labeling is that labels never take into consideration your strengths. And of course, what really counts when you grow up is how strong your strengths are.
So where does that leave Ritalin in this conversation?
Well, in a sense, we can still use medication appropriately if we really understand the child and understand where his breakdowns are occurring. And we would say medication wouldn't be used to sort of cure ADD. It would be used to strengthen the attention controls.
Why don't you tell us what the different forms of attention are?
There are 14 different controls of attention. It's like a great control panel up in your mind, and they play a role, at least some of them do, in absolutely everything you do as a kid and also as an adult in a career and in everyday life. We divide the attention controls into three areas. One is mental energy control, and mental energy control just gives you the fuel you need to get things done, to do things you don't feel like doing, to concentrate, to exert mental effort. And mental energy control also involves your ability to turn off the flow of mental energy so you can fall asleep at night, and to turn it up high during the day so you can be tuned in and effortful and effective throughout your day at school or at work. So the balance between sleep and wakefulness is also part of the control of the flow of mental energy. And by the way, we see some children who have a lot of trouble sleeping at night and a lot of trouble functioning during the day. There are some adults like that as well.
So that's one of the ways in which you might diagnose this deficiency in this one part of attention.
Yes, and I can't emphasize enough that different children who have attentional problems have different combinations of weaknesses in the controls. It's not as if you've seen one, you've seen them all. There's tremendous variation. The second area of attention I like to call intake or processing control. It's your mind's ability to deal with information that's sort of right at your doorstep, ready to come into consciousness. And it's sort of cleaning up the data so you can use it, so you can remember it, so you can really understand it effectively. For example, one part of intake control is selection, or what we call saliency determination. Of all the information sort of competing for your consciousness, what's really important here? What's really salient? What should I tune into and what should I filter out? So when you're sitting in the classroom, you can listen to the teacher instead of looking out the window. And by the way, issues relating to what's important and what isn't important become some of the most common learning disorders of high school students. Knowing what to study for an exam, knowing how to take notes, and I can tell you so many teenagers whom I've seen with learning problems tell you, when I get to the end of a chapter, I have no idea what I've just read. Meaning they couldn't tease out relative degrees of saliency or importance. Everything was sort of a straight line, a blur for them. And that puts them tremendously at risk for failure.
Is this directly related to prioritizing also?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, I have to tell you one other interesting thing. I gave a workshop recently for a group of college professors, which I don't ordinarily do. And this was at a major university, and the dean of the law school was there. And when he heard me talk about saliency determination, about your ability to filter out what's unimportant and focus on what's important, he said that's probably, difficulty with that is probably the most common cause of dropout from law school. Law students who really look at a case and can't figure out what's relevant and what's irrelevant. And boy, do they dissipate in law school. Another one of the processing controls is, once information sort of gets in through the gateway of consciousness, how deeply are you going to process it? How well will it take root in your mind? You know, we have an old expression in English, it went in one ear and out the other. That's called superficial processing, as opposed to deep enough processing, so it really takes hold. And there are some children who can't follow directions because they never really let anything get in far enough, so you have to keep repeating things to them. And interestingly enough, many individuals whose processing is superficial, where information doesn't get in very far, turn out to be phenomenal at seeing the big picture, at going through life with a wide-angle lens on, but they hate details.
Mm. So when you're confronted with a kid who is having some kind of trouble in school and right. ends up in your office, how do you tease out these very specific weaknesses in them? How do you evaluate them for them?
There are many different ways. First and foremost, someone trying to evaluate a child has to have some knowledge of what the possibilities are. You know, I'm a pediatrician, and in medicine we have something called differential diagnosis. If a child has a fever and a rash and she's 9 months old, what are the things I need to be thinking about? And we do the same thing when it comes to these learning issues. If a kid is 13 and still doesn't know his multiplication facts and is having a lot of difficulty in algebra, what are the things I have to be thinking about that might be causing that breakdown? And we look at samples of the child's work. We interview the child. You wouldn't believe, Barbara, how often a kid can tell you, if you ask the right questions, exactly where his breakdown is occurring. Tommy, do you have trouble understanding math or remembering it? He can say, oh, I always understand it when the teacher explains it. I could teach it to everybody else, and then I can't remember how to do it on the test.
Dr. Mel Levine is a developmental pediatrician. He's the director of the University of North Carolina's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. His new book is A Mind at a Time. We have a short break now, Mel, and then we'll talk some more.
Great.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mel Levine. He's the director of the Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning at the University of North Carolina. His new book is A Mind at a Time. Let's talk about memory for a moment, because you write in the book that often kids who get labeled learning disabled, or just plain called stupid by everyone, have very distinct memory deficiencies. Is that something easy to diagnose, or does it get overlooked in this labeling of LD, learning disabled, or ADD?
It's easy to diagnose, and it almost always gets overlooked. It's just extraordinary how many kids with memory difficulties are just not having their memory problems identified. And now that we know how to do these things, why aren't we recognizing them? And by the way, some retaining a child in a grade does nothing to improve his memory.
So are there easy ways or very direct ways to compensate for a memory problem, strategies to improve memory once you pinpoint a deficiency? And is that something teachers should teach kids in school?
Absolutely. It's unbelievable how much memory is required in school and how we never bother to teach kids how memory works. In fact, I have a strong bias, and all of our programs do, that children ought to be learning about learning while they're learning, that part of learning ought to be learning how to work your mind. Otherwise, it's like driving a car without driver's ed. And we know so much about how learning works, but we're not telling the teachers and we're not telling the students.
Well, give us an idea of some of the tricks, the basic tricks that teachers could lay out for kids. And I was interested in one thing that you wrote, that the best way to remember something, say for a test, is to transform it. In other words, if something you're trying to remember is verbal, make it visual, make a diagram for yourself. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. That's one method, is keep recoding information. If it comes in visually, like a diagram, put it into words, describe it. If it comes in verbally, try to make a diagram of it, try to make a chart, try to picture it, try to think of examples of it in your own life. The more you extend information, the more you elaborate it, the more you modify it in one way or another, the more effectively it gets filed in memory. It's also important to teach kids that they need to put information in categories, that you don't put things in memory without attaching them to something. Let me give you an example that shows this. Long about age 9, children develop a filing system in their minds. They actually develop folders that they can put information in. If you ask a 7-year-old to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds, he'll say robin, shark, cow, dog, spider. If you ask a 13-year-old with a well-organized memory to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds, he'll say cow, chicken, turkey, pig, lion, tiger, giraffe, elephant, rhino, spider, ant, bee. Do you see what he's doing?
They put them in phylum in classes.
Yes, he's going from one folder to another. He can name 10 times as many animals as that 7-year-old. And if you see a 13-year-old and you ask him to name as many animals as he can in 30 seconds and he sounds like a 7-year-old, you know he's failing tests in school. He has no folders. He's got to be taught how to do that. And so often, what comes intuitively and naturally to certain kinds of minds has to be taught formally to other kinds of minds. Every single one of us has things that we can do so well intuitively and things that we're going to have to be led through formally.
There was a little trick that you wrote about in the book that I never thought of, that long-term memory filing works best right before you go to sleep.
Absolutely.
How would you apply that?
Well, kids have to know you study for exams right before you go to sleep, and by all means, do not study and then take a shower and then go to sleep, because then all you remember in the morning is the shampoo. You have to take the shower first and then study and then go to sleep. And what you study right before you go to sleep gets replayed about 5 times after you fall asleep. It has instant replay built into it. This is one of the many, many sort of memory tricks of the trade that I think students ought to know about. And in addition to that, you know, maybe everybody's memory works a little differently. So once you get a child or an adolescent started with the general advice, you can then charge him with the responsibility. And why don't you try to figure out how your memory works best, what things you need to do to prime your memory best.
Now, looking at how long-term memory works, is there a neurological argument against the typical organization of the school day, that you go from 45 minutes of math to 45 minutes of English to 45 minutes of social studies? Does that chopped-up day promote consolidation of learning, or does it just break up the flow?
There's no doubt about it that once information enters your mind, it needs some time to consolidate. I believe that after a 40-minute class session in school, the kids ought to get together in small groups to discuss what just went on, elaborate on it, change it in the ways I just described, and give it time to consolidate. If that doesn't happen, then social studies erases algebra and Spanish erases social studies. Each class kind of deletes much of what went on during the class before.
So is there a neurological argument then for block scheduling?
Block scheduling is another option, that you would have a particular 2-month period, let's say, where you do mainly biology, and another 2-month period mainly for English, and so on. And by the way, I don't think that has to be extreme. You could say that it would be mainly biology, but you'll also be having some quick reviews of English and some small segments of other things just for booster doses. So one wouldn't have to totally let go of everything else, but one could have a strong central emphasis during each block.
So what systems of mind does our school system play to? Is it out of balance with our biology, our mind's workings?
I believe so, and I think in the most concrete way, I think school overutilizes memory. You know, at no point in life, in almost no career that you can name, do you need as much memory as you do in school, especially nowadays when your hard drive tends to be on your desk, so it doesn't all need to be intracranial. And I think schools have to realize, in the way they design tests, in the way they prepare students, that we don't want kids to come to think that learning is remembering, learning is regurgitation. And I think there's an imbalance now between understanding and remembering. And many students feel if they remember something, they understand it. I believe even some of the standardized high-stakes testing that's occurring across the country right now is perhaps placing too much emphasis on rote memory and not enough on insight and understanding. I don't think that's an incurable condition, but I think there's a tendency toward that right now.
Well, schools need tests. Kids need tests. Mm-hmm. How could they be better devised then to recognize the different ways that kids' brains work? Should kids be able to bring notes to tests, or many tests should include you're allowed to bring notes?
How's this, Barbara? Why don't we say you're going to have an hour test today. The first 20 minutes are without your notes, and for the last 40 minutes, I'd like you to take out your notes. So that we're really explaining to kids there's a certain amount of knowledge that you have to just plain know and store away, but then there's also something called understanding and judgment and brainstorming and critical thinking that we'd like you to move into.
You write a lot about the role of language in learning, that a lot of kids with language problems get misdiagnosed as having attention problems. How do you tell them apart?
I think there are a lot of ways we can tell attentional difficulties from language difficulties. For example, you may see that a child is having trouble concentrating, is really having trouble filtering out distractions and pacing himself and being able to stay tuned into the important details. But you may notice that only happens in highly verbal settings. He doesn't have that problem when he's playing his computer games. He doesn't have that difficulty when he's doing hands-on activities that involve a lot of visual input. But when it's pure language, you lose this child. Then you might be more apt to suspect a language problem than an attentional problem. And I hasten to add that it's possible to have both, to have trouble with attention plus language. But we try to sort those out as well as we can.
Dr. Mel Levine is the director of the University of North Carolina's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. His new book is A Mind at a Time. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Dr. Mel Levine. He teaches pediatrics at the University of North Carolina Medical School and is the co-founder and co-director of All Kinds of Minds, a nonprofit institute which develops programs to address learning differences in children. His new book is A Mind at a Time. When we left off, we were discussing how language problems often go undetected in kids at school and can really trip them up. I asked Mel Levine what parents and teachers can do to help.
There are a lot of different things. I think that whether we like it or not, schools are designed for linguists. In many ways, it's a shame because there are some wonderful kinds of minds that get destroyed by school because they think non-verbally. They visualize rather than verbalize all the time. And the adult world has endless numbers of jobs for people who are better at thinking without language. All the different technological fields. I can't tell you how many former patients of mine are now designing websites and engaging in other activities that involve really pre-visualizing things more than verbalizing. But we still have to worry about getting these kids through school and having them survive in that highly verbal universe called education. And so there is a lot of things that parents can do. For example, we know that during elementary school, the most important part of language is at the sentence level. That's when the brain really becomes increasingly efficient and precise in dealing with sentences, with the relationship between word order and meaning, with clauses inside of sentences, and therefore understanding directions, understanding explanations. There's just this highly accelerated development of sentence comprehension and sentence construction during elementary school. What does that mean? It means that every parent ought to be saying, in our home, we only talk in full sentences. We don't say stuff. We don't say thing. We don't use little phrases. We got to build those sentence muscles because you're 9 years old, and that's crucial. And every classroom teacher ought to be the same thing, be saying the same thing.
Oh, there'd be a lot of changes in my house.
Go for it. But, you know, if you think about it, sentences not only build language, they build logical thinking. Words like although, unless, until, instead of, aren't those the cornerstones of thinking logically and reasoning? And so every time you're building a sentence, you're also fortifying your rational thinking equipment.
So when you say demystify for the child what is holding him or her back in school, is the point of that so much of the agony of school is that you feel dumb? And even if you're
Absolutely.
Not good, you're pretty great at 3 out of 4 subjects, but you're really bad at one, you feel like a loser.
Absolutely. And there's so much misunderstanding, and so often children write themselves off. They think that what's wrong with them is so much worse than what's wrong with them. That they decide they were born to lose, that they may as well give up, that they may as well find other kids in town who feel the same way and band together and go to the mall on Saturday and ultimately get into drugs and get into trouble because they've written themselves off. The most horrible complication of learning difficulty in my mind is called pessimism.
What place, then, does this label learning disabled have in the educational system?
In my opinion, it's served its purpose, and it's time to move beyond the label of learning disabled, because to most people, learning disabled means that a kid fits a particular formula that says that he's eligible for services, that he has a difference between his IQ and his achievement testing. And now that we know the broad array of learning problems that kids have. That makes no sense whatsoever. It's hard to know where to draw the line, what to include as a learning disability and what not to include. If a kid has trouble managing time, is that a learning disability? If a child does well academically but has trouble expressing himself when he talks, is that a learning disability? Are the attentional controls learning issues and weak attention controls therefore learning disabilities, or are they not? It's just silly. We really want to look at profiles of strengths and weaknesses. And we don't want kids to grow up feeling they're defective, that they have a label. So I think we can help kids without labeling them, without testing them to see if we can help them. Can you imagine a person falling off a ship and beginning to drown, and we say, I'm sorry, we can't save you until you've had a swimming test. Or we can't save you because we know you can't swim, but it's part of an overall gross motor problem. It's not a specific disability, so we can't save you. And that's what's going on, that kind of thinking in schools all the time. You have to be eligible according to some very narrow criteria for us to be able to even acknowledge that you're struggling with your wiring.
Well, someone might say, just to play devil's advocate, that
sure.
if every mind works so differently, how can we expect schools to address these myriad of varieties of learning deficits, that you have to draw the line somewhere and you have to have a test that separates, you know, a certain level of difficulty in struggling with school from another?
Well, let me address that in several different ways with you. First of all, we're really not saying that every single kid in a classroom has to be taught differently. That's not the case. There's a basic way, a basic sort of core way that we're addressing all of them. But we can individualize within that context as needed. For example, many children with sequencing problems hate to use cursive writing because it's such a complicated sequence. And they go up and tell you, I'd much rather print than do cursive. I hate cursive writing and I do it too slow and it's too hard for me. It doesn't really cost any money out of the school budget or drain any resources to say to that child, that's fine, why don't you just print for the rest of your life? If you know that a child has trouble with retrieval memory, and Barbara, when you're called on in class, you have 3 seconds to respond to a question, it really doesn't cost anything to say to the child, I'm going to call on you tomorrow to ask you about the causes of World War II. Can you be ready for that? So these are little accommodations, little aspects of flexibility that don't really mean you're teaching every single child differently, but it does mean you're willing to be somewhat flexible with every child.
But is it fair to the other kids, the kids who have to write cursive and who aren't given a fair warning of when they'll be called on in class?
I met a teacher recently who told me that she gets up in front of the class on the first day of class and looks out there and says, look here, kids, I want you to know one thing. I'm not treating any two of you alike this year. There's some of you who are going to write long papers and some of you shorter papers. Some of you are going to read longer stories and some of you shorter stories. She said, I don't intend to treat any two of you the same and you shouldn't want to be treated the same. And she set that up as the sort of ethos, as the way of thinking in her classroom, sort of celebrating diversity. And she said she does that every year and there's never any problem. She never hears another word out of any kid because that's the way her class works.
Mel Levine, thanks a lot for talking today on Fresh Air.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Mel Levine, his new book is A Mind at a Time. He's the co-director of the All Kinds of Minds Institute based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is Fresh Air.